Welcome everyone to the episode 6 of the Office Hours podcast. Today we have with us Mo, and let's see what kind of topics we're going to discuss today. Take it away, Mo.
Thank you, Vasily. How you doing?
I'm doing well. The on-call week was quite busy for me. As you can tell, I had to delay releasing the previous episode by pretty much a week. I couldn't really get to it to finish all of the cutting and processing and all of that good stuff. But it's out now, so hopefully you had a chance to check it out. It's been an interesting experience. It's been quite busy, and you're sort of exposed to the system from angles you never really considered before. And at first it was like, oh my God, I have no idea what I'm doing. But our team is great. They were very helpful in finding out all the necessary information. So I think it went well. The only thing I was not a fan of is getting up at 5:50 to kind of get there in time for the shift takeover.
Yeah.
So, a little bit tired more than usual. But thankfully it's long weekend. It's going to be BC Day. And I don't know if you guys have it in Quebec.
But
Ontario does, and BC also does. So we have Monday off, which is welcome. Nice. Yeah.
We don't. I guess we've had our fair share of holidays already. But it's good. It's okay. I think we have another day somewhere in September. But we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was kind of the same, but I wasn't on call. I was just up to different things over the week.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, I started taking Twitter content a bit more seriously. I started contributing to Twitter community, tech community on Twitter.
It's called X now.
It's called X, exactly. It's called X, right? But you know what? How do you feel about changing the name, though? I feel Elon came in and then he changed a lot of things. Now he's changing the name, and I wonder what Twitter is going to become. I'm not too sure. I don't know if I'm a fan of it.
Well, back in the day, at one of the companies we were working on, we had this thing where we tried giving names to things that didn't have additional connotation to them. Because if you have something called something specific, people will have their own ideas about what it should be. And it might not necessarily be that. And so I remember bits of information we were getting from the back end for a particular geography were called Bob's, B-O-B, Bob. And it's why is it called Bob? Well, why not, right? It's Bob. Mm-hmm. When you think about data and Bob together in the same sentence, there's nothing there. So you have no expectations about it, and you're not biased from the start. And maybe it's kind of same with that. When people think of Twitter, they think about a very particular thing, a very particular kind of environment, community, style of communication. It's kind of this public debate blood sport, which not everybody potentially appreciates, right? And so maybe it's just cut it off, start with a new thing, do not have people have preconceived notions about it, and see how it goes from there. Because, it's been making a lot of changes in terms of moderation policy and free speech, things like that. So all good things, in my opinion. And people say, the Twitter has built up this brand and he's destroying the brand. Twitter was nothing at some point in time, and it developed. So X will develop too. And that's fine.
Would you say you're an Elon fan?
I'm not an Elon fanboy in the sense that, everything that comes out of the man's mouth is gospel straight into my ears. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's a lot of opinions about it. And, I watched a couple of podcasts with him. He's a very intelligent, quirky kind of guy. A very nerdy kind of guy. So if I was more diligent and put more effort into the things I'm doing, I could have been more like that guy in terms of his productive output. But on all of the nerdy things, I think we're kind of similar in ways. I get his jokes. Yeah. So
yeah. But That's something, yeah. I was thinking about it. Like, I saw, I don't know, you know, Sam Altman, right?
Mm-hmm.
The GPT guy.
Yeah.
I saw his portfolio recently about all the companies that he is responsible for. And I started thinking about it, like, how does he have the time to do anything else? Like, when does he get the time to actually live his life? Because I don't have as much, my portfolio is not the same, but sometimes I complain. Like, I'm like, I just want some time for myself. But how does this people like this have time for themselves?
They probably don't.
But how do they live? Don't they talk about burnout? Because for me, if I don't get enough sleep, I'm talking about burnout. Don't people like that also get burnout?
I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe they... it's hard to say. You know, we talked about burnout and we talked about like work-life balance in the previous one.
That's true.
Yeah. And it was, it's like some people do work 80 hours a week and don't see a problem with that. And, you know, it, you know, there is stress and then there's your response to stress. And if you can control how you respond to stress or you're just naturally more resilient to it, then, you know, the same level of stress that would have been causing burnout for me is not going to do that much for you. So, you know, it's highly, highly individual. And thankfully, there's only like a handful of people that are able to do that. Otherwise, I don't know, it'd be very, very different place we'd be living in if everyone was just going like balls out to the wall completely every single time. Yeah.
So you think it's training, right? Like, it's just training yourself to be more comfortable with certain level of stress.
I think you can probably become better at coping with stress, but maybe you kind of have to understand the proper approach for doing it. Like, I think if you just casually listen to like Jocko Willing or David Goggins and it's like, yeah, I wake up at 4:30 a.m. and, you know, and like, you know, all of the memes of just doing completely outrageous things, I'm pretty sure if you just do it kind of naively, it might not work out. Like, you have to be more deliberate about it, kind of understand what you're doing, maybe some psychology, maybe some physiology. And then the question is also, like, what are you hoping to gain out of it? You know?
Yeah, I get that. But you see, like, the question now is, see, for example, first of all, I don't think it's outrageous to wake up at 4:30 in the morning. I think it's good to wake up early because if you get your morning right, you can get your day very good. But yeah, that's bad, by the way. But you see, like, people, for example, I was listening to Kevin Hart, you know?
The comedian?
Kevin Hart, the comedian. And I find that he's always busy. Like, you probably, everywhere you look in the entertainment industry, movies, comedy shows, podcasts, YouTube, he's everywhere. Like, I wonder how that guy actually has any time for himself. So sometimes when I want to start looking at myself, like, oh, maybe I have like a lot going on. And then I start thinking like, oh, what about these people? Like, do they sleep? How do you prioritize all these things and do it well? Because there's a difference between doing a lot of things and doing a lot of things well. You know, like, you can do it, a lot of things.
But like, when you say time for yourself, what exactly do you mean by that? Like, what does constitute time for yourself?
For example, me, when I say time for myself, it's just like, just don't do anything, you know? Time when you are able to just sit down and not do anything. Just probably just stay in the wall, look at the sky, or do whatever you want. Just not be concerned about like, oh, I gotta finish this task now. That's time for myself. I can do whatever I want with it. I can sit in the jacuzzi, whatever I want. I can sit in the pool, whatever I want, you know? That's me time,
right? You know? But if you don't have that desire to just do that. I mean, if you have the desire to get stuff done, how is that worse for you? Like, I've been busy the previous week, and now with the podcasting, I have to like figure out a whole bunch of things in terms of, you know, how to edit the video, how to edit the audio, how to like do all of these different things. And I find that time kind of flies. Like yesterday, I was, oh man, I have to release this thing tomorrow around noon or so. And I'm just sitting there just doing it. And it's like, oh wow, it's time for bed already, you know, and I'm still not finished. And I would have gone for longer. So the thing is that usually I find it more difficult to cultivate that state, like getting in that state. So maybe they just, it's not for them as much of dealing with stress, because I wasn't stressed out by the fact that I was working for the entire day. I was having fun, and time flies when you're having fun, right? So maybe their secret trick is not necessarily dealing with stress or being more resilient, but rather having the ability to enter that state kind of on demand and stay within it and just kind of have at it while they're in it, right? Because it's you know, everybody experiences, you know, like the state of flow, they call it, right? Where time flies, you're like hyper focused, and it just pure creative process, and it's really nice. And I've experienced it a bunch of times, but it was very difficult to experience it consistently. I had bouts where I was experiencing that kind of stuff consistently. But it's not like an everyday thing. And if it was an everyday thing, I'd probably be very successful because I just get more stuff done.
You know, yeah, I think so. Maybe it's because what I considered was like, maybe there is this saying that you gotta enjoy what you do, and what you do has to be like fun for you, and you have to be able to do it all the time. But I understand, like, even with this flow thing, like being in the zone, I think the way the brain works, like, as much as I know, you need rest, you need a break. And I don't know how much breaks like will be sufficient. But I agree with you. I think at the end of the day, it's about training. I agree. I think this is true. It's about training yourself to have some like threshold or like some.
Yeah. I think also that to get to the state where you're training, you know, it's kind of been a theme in our previous couple of episodes. It's like training yourself to do uncomfortable things. But in order to start training yourself to do uncomfortable things, you have to start doing the things with like some degree of discomfort, and then sort of like gradually increase it in a sense. So there's a natural bar to entry. Like, you have to be at least committed to doing this much uncomfortable stuff before you're ready to do that much. And yeah, I think a lot of people aren't capable of just walking over that tiny little bump in the very beginning of it. And so nothing is gonna happen, right?
Do you think meditation helps with like productivity?
I tried a couple of times because it's been kind of a fad, you know. A lot of people swear by it. There was one form of meditation which I did try, and it did kind of help, and it's very, very easy. It was what, I don't remember this guy's name. He's like a Buddhist monk, and he was talking about, you know, how you have like the monkey mind and your human mind, and the monkey mind is constantly trying to like interfere in your day and just, you know, do random stuff and like not do anything particularly productive. And so the trick is to occupy the monkey mind with some menial task so that it's just sitting off to the side doing its own thing, and you meanwhile can do other things. And he was basically saying, oh, you know, to meditate doesn't mean you have to sit there with your eyes closed for an hour and like not think about anything. It's not the goal, right? The goal is to occupy your monkey mind. So you can give it a task. It's like, oh, count the numbers of times you inhale and exhale. And that's enough. And if you do it for 5 minutes, that's already good. And at some point in time, I did try it and it was working out surprisingly well. So, but in terms of like, sit with your legs crossed and stare into the void and empty your mind for an hour, like that never really worked for me.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think both sitting into the with your legs crossed and looking at whatever for an hour, maybe an hour is a lot. I don't know. I don't know if there's a lot of people that can actually sit that like that for an hour. But I think they both have like different effects. Like there was a time in my life where I was really looking into meditations.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, the only thing is I don't know if it helps with productivity. I don't think I can answer that question really. But I know it helps in like different ways maybe. But that's probably just part for, I don't know.
Mm.
Like it makes you calm. It makes you be able to understand, to process things better. Like you'll be able to control your mind. It helps with your focus and maybe some aspects of concentration. But I don't know about productivity. I don't know if it's gonna get you up at 4:30. I don't know. It depends on the desire. I don't know. That's what I'm not too sure about, because I also know there are different types of meditation. Do you think like say when you mentioned like giving your the monkey mind like a task, do you think that's the idea behind listening to music while working?
Maybe. I don't know. There, like, not all music works. Like, for me, it has to be... That's why I like listening to video game soundtracks. Because I think they are, by design, made so that they're there and they sound nice, but they don't distract too much of your attention from the game itself. They're there, like, in a complementary sense. And so I find that some game soundtracks work really well. Because especially, you know, you can find a YouTube video and it's going to be like 4.5 hours of the full soundtrack to this game. And you just turn it on and it works out really quite well for me. That's because I find like if it's a song with lyrics, or if it's a song that I know or enjoy, it tries to pull too much attention toward itself. Because for me, music is kind of very linked to very many memories. And then when I hear certain songs, like a lot of the memories like start sort of appearing in the periphery of my conscious, and then that's distracting. But like, so I have to be careful about what kind of music I pick for listening to while I work.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's kind of interesting. Sometimes, again, it depends on the state you're in, because I could have something playing in the background, into like a podcast where people are talking. And if I am not sort of in that zone or close to it, I'd find that a lot of my attention is being grabbed by what they're talking about. So I start focusing more. But sometimes I kind of have it playing and then I get focused on some task that I'm doing, some tiny thing. And all of that sort of shifts in the background. And then I realize like, oh, they finished talking half an hour ago. And it didn't matter what they were talking about. It all got filtered out. It was nice having it on a background, because it's not like, there's like some sensory stimulation that like you're surrounded by something. But it's not drawing that much attention. So it's like your brain says, okay, this is not important. That is important right now. We're switching over. And, you know, one other interesting thing that I heard is like, you know, how we listen to like a lot of like audiobooks and podcasts, and this person was comparing it in a sense to schizophrenia, because you're hearing things that aren't really there. You know, you're like hearing voices of people that are not next to you. And we don't even know if it has like kind of weird effects on a brain, because, you know, it's like ghostly disembodied voices that you're just randomly hearing in your head.
So, I don't agree with that. I don't know.
I don't necessarily agree with that either, but it was an interesting kind of observation. It's like, oh, you're hearing voices, you say, in your ear all the time.
I mean, there's a lot of things to do to prove that, because what about phone calls? I know, like, if you listen to a certain music for a long time, it starts to play in your head, even when you're no longer listening to it. But does that add up to schizophrenia?
I don't know.
How do you say that?
Schizophrenia?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. That's a long shot.
I mean, yeah. Sure. I don't know. I don't know 100% how real that comparison is. I just thought it was kind of interesting. Because, you know, it's like the Tetris effect, where they did studies and people were playing Tetris. You played Tetris, right? Everybody played Tetris.
Yeah.
And I had that too. I had Tetris dreams after playing Tetris, like for real. So it's a thing. But an interesting thing was where they gave people with short-term memory loss... They play Tetris, and they have short-term memory loss, so they couldn't remember the process of actually playing, but they could recall the gameplay mechanics pretty vividly, even though they weren't aware post-factum that they'd done it. So that was pretty interesting.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot about science that we're just, like, finding out. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how that plays out. But you know what? You mentioned something that caught my attention, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the type of music that you like to listen to. There was a time I was watching a documentary, and then I learned about how music affects the brain. There is a myth that says, like, if you listen to classical music more, you probably be smarter. Like, it makes you smarter, and it makes you solve more complex problems in faster time than people who don't listen to classical. It was a myth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the purpose of that documentary was to prove if it's true or not. And the interesting thing is, like, some people were made to listen to other type of music, like jazz, and some people were made to listen to, like, classical music. But what turns out was that, like, and the music kind of help your brain to produce dopamine. And it's the dopamine that excites you and makes you actually solve those problems. So the question now is, like, do you feel like you can have dopamine with others, in like other sources that can help you be more productive? Or, like, do you think, like, dopamine from, like, just listen audio from audio enough? Yeah, and if you have, like, other sources of dopamine, I'm curious, like, what are your other sources of dopamine that are actually more productive?
Right. You ever get shivers when you listen to music? You have, like, the hair on your arms standing up when you're listening to a particular piece of music. Have you ever experienced that?
No.
Oh, that's
I want to dance when I listen to music sometimes. But other than that, no. What kind of music do you listen to that makes your hair stand up?
See, it's interesting. It doesn't have to be any particular style. Although I have to say that I remember, like, uplifting trance back in, like, 2000s. That did way more of that. That had way more of that effect than other things. And to me, it'd be interesting. It'd be some particular phrase in a melody, and it's just like, you know, you have this effect.
Yeah.
And in terms of, like, listening to classical music makes you smarter, I don't necessarily know. I think classical music has a lot of nuance, like, way more than pop music. And I mean, rock music can be pretty sophisticated as well, but classical music is very sophisticated in terms of just everything that's in there. And not to sound like a complete snob, it's like, oh, you have to listen to classical music.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do like classical music. I listen to quite a bit of it. I mean, I'm probably quite pedestrian in my tastes, and I wouldn't necessarily be able to tell you a lot of specific pieces by specific composers that I enjoy. And I have to probably attribute a lot of my classical music knowledge to Tom and Jerry, which did bang up job at it, because they had a lot of classical pieces in their cartoons. And when I was a kid, you know, you watch Tom and Jerry, you listen to a lot of classical music.
I got some of that too.
And I do know a lot of it by heart, in a sense, like, I can follow, I can like whistle the tune of a lot of classical pieces. So I don't know. Maybe that made me smart. And
Maybe, just maybe that's the reason.
Yeah, who the hell knows? Yeah. But yeah, and yeah, I remember watching this documentary where they would play old people who like live in like a retirement home. They would play them music from their like young adulthood days. And those, a lot of these people, they would like have dementia or some degree of like senility, essentially. They, for a lot of them, they would not communicate. They just sort of sit there, which was kind of sad. And then, you know, this nurse has this iPod with some dance music from like 1930s, and he plays it for this older gentleman, and he just like a light bulb turns on. He just transforms. He like starts dancing. He starts like talking to her. He gets like completely animated by it. So yeah, music has quite a massive effect, for sure.
But I'm curious, like, do you have another source of dopamine as well?
Yeah, that is a good question. I had some thoughts on it, but I don't know if I can formulate all of them right now. I mean, like, doing physical activity is great. Like, working out is great.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's hard to say. I haven't really thought about it in a long time. I feel like right now I'm not in the state where I have to think about it. My natural state is kind of very calm and even and good. Like, I'm not really stressing out about too many things right now. So it's not really like a problem for me that I have to solve. So I'm sort of pretty happy where I am.
That's good.
Yeah. Like, even the fact that I have to like work longer hours, or it doesn't really bother me that much. And I think that it comes down more to overall chemistry and neurotransmitters and all of that good stuff, which, you know, might tie in nicely into the whole topic we brought up last time about like what you eat, because, you know, a lot of that stuff, it's built from the things you eat. So if you eat wrong things, you're going to have problems with your hormones, with your neurotransmitters and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, since I've been doing carnivore, I noticed marked improvements in my sort of mood, evenness of my mood, like mental health overall. We talked about anxiety briefly last time, but apart from that, like just this state of even calm where you're not like shifted in or out as much. You know, I even heard some things that, you know, people with bipolar disorder, if they go on that type of lifestyle, it severely sort of condenses the range, because they, you know, they can go hyper or they can go depressive, and they go hyper and depressive and things like that. They kind of like flip-flop between them, but it sort of brings everything much closer, so the extremes are not as extreme, which I don't know if it's a research. I don't know how well it's been confirmed clinically, but it's just like an anecdote that I heard about it. So
I think I can relate to that, because you know, it's my fourth month of being a carnivore, and it's going good, and I think I can actually relate to that, because before doing carnivore, there were some health things. It wasn't like I was sick or anything. I just, like, sometimes I felt like my energy level was not as balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the most significant things that I've noticed. Like, I feel like I get more things done throughout the day because I have more energy to get through the day, just by changing what I eat. Honestly, yeah, I really agree that what you eat matters a lot. Like, and it's interesting that you can just keep your food, like your food choices, to just being animals and animal products alone.
Mm-hmm.
I think like saying that to people alone just like makes them go, oh, whoa, hold up, just animals and like, what are you eating, you know? But it just makes it simple and easy to
yeah,
to look into, really.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it too, because I think for most part, not too many people are studying the topic in depth, and all of our dietary knowledge usually comes from your parents. It's like, eat that broccoli, it's good for you. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the broccoli and what it has inside of it, mm-hmm. probably not that great for you, to be honest. So it's one of those myths that hasn't been really fully disproven. And I was never one for vegetables, to be honest. I never really enjoyed them. And I had to eat them out of necessity, because, you know, when your parents feed you, you're just going to eat whatever they give to you. I don't know how it works these days in Western countries, mm-hmm. where kids mm-hmm. can say, I'm not going to eat that, take me to McDonald's, and the parents will oblige. But, that, you know,
nice.
Back in the late 80s, early 90s, post-Soviet Belarus, that was not an option at all. And so you eat whatever your parents give you, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, going to McDonald's was an occasion. When they finally opened one in our city, it was like a huge deal. But that was never a sort of staple. Fast food was never a staple. In fact, right now, there's like a big trend of going away from home-cooked meals. Everybody's getting takeout. Everybody's eating fast food. Everybody's eating at the restaurants. You know, the delivery services can bring you whatever at any time of day. Like, not many people, I guess, learn how to cook or find enjoyment in it. You know, I hear it. We have some friends that are like an older generation from ours. And, you know, mm-hmm. they have kids who are like teenagers, and they always complain. It's like, there's a full fridge of food at home, and the teenager comes in and it's like, we have nothing to eat. I'm literally starving. It's like, there's a full fridge of food in there. You just need to make it. And they have no clue what that means.
Yeah, make it. That's a lot. Mm-hmm. Do you think you enjoy cooking?
It's funny. I do enjoy cooking. I really enjoyed watching not like cooking shows, like TV style cooking shows, but like YouTube channels. Like, you know that channel Binging with Babish? That guy's really good. He's like he got really popular. And I remember watching his channel where it was like kind of smallish, not so super popular as he is right now, but I really enjoyed watching it, and I still do. And there's other channel called, I think right now it's just called Alex. It used to be called Alex the French Guy Cooking, and it's like this guy in Paris. He's an engineer, and he kind of nerds out about culinary things. But it's funny, because most of the things they make, I would prefer not to eat these days. Yeah, so as much as I enjoyed cooking in general, I now, guess, choose not to cook those things or eat those things, because they do affect how I feel and how I operate. And every time I sort of get off the lifestyle and revert back to like more standard way of eating, I definitely feel the difference. And mm-hmm. it gets difficult coming back to it. Like, getting on it the first time around was really hard.
I can imagine.
It required a lot of effort and dedication. Like, several months worth of... Like, I remember periods of time where I was, like, driving home from work, and at the intersection, like, do I go straight and drop by the store and pick up, like, a brownie or something? Or do I turn left and just go home and ignore... And I'd be there, like, oh, what should I... And then, like... make myself take a turn and not go to the store. It was a battle. It was a battle every time. Yeah. And it still yeah. is, in a sense, because I don't know. A lot of the standard diet mm-hmm. is kind of very based on like carbs and sugars in particular. Mm-hmm. And that stuff is really addictive. It's probably it's really as addictive as cocaine. You know, they did some studies in terms of like what areas of brain light up when people have sugar, and I think they said it's like pretty much the same thing, the same areas that cocaine triggers, the sugar triggers as well. So that stuff is very addictive and very available, and getting off of it is really hard. You know, you go to the store, every aisle in the store, like 95% of the store is going to be carb based stuff with added sugars and with other things that you don't want to eat. It's crazy.
You know what? Like when you mentioned like the scenario about you driving, something similar happened to me literally yesterday. So I went to the store. I was supposed to get just some things for some meat. And then I passed by one of the aisles and then I saw this really nice looking cake. And then I can tell you, I literally felt the taste of the cake. I don't know what it tastes like, but I felt the taste of the sugar in my mouth. Like I could feel it in my mouth. And it was so strong. And I started telling myself, like, you know what? It's not bad for you to have sugar. Some sugar is good. You know?
It's not bad for you to have just a little bit of heroin, you know, it's okay, just a little tiny bit, yeah, it's fine. Bit,
you know, mm-hmm. just balance it out. And then I started telling him, okay, no, this is the work exactly, you have to be disciplined, so keep going, but I know it's hard, but you know what?
Yeah, it is.
You know what? Earlier, I asked you about, like, other sources of dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
You think, like, having sugar, like, sugary stuff, like, the actual source of dopamine itself, because gets you excited, you know?
I think it is. It kind of has to be evolutionarily. And again, I'm not an expert in these things. This is just my speculation. But there was an interesting theory that I heard. I don't know how much in the weeds I'm going to go. But basically, like, storing fat in your body is mediated by insulin. And insulin is mediated by, you know, glucose, aka, you know, sugar. Half of it is glucose. So if you consume a lot of sugar, spikes your insulin, like it sets off all these biochemical processes in your body. And someone said, like, people used to eat fruit in the summer to gain fat for the upcoming winter. So it was necessary, right? Because the food might not have been readily available throughout winter as easily. And so if you manage to bulk up and accumulate a lot of subcutaneous fat, that'll be good for you in the winter, because then you can just burn out fat throughout the window and compensate for lack of, you know, food that you'd get otherwise. And in order to make you do anything, it has to be pleasurable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like most necessary things in life are pleasurable. And I think modern things hijack those mechanisms, and that's why they're so addictive, because you weren't supposed to have access to that much sugar and, you know, all the other things that come out of that same logic. It's like you weren't supposed to have access to that much of it. It was supposed to be like a little tiny thing to give you that little hit to say, oh, you know, next time you have a chance to do it. But now the next time you have a chance to do it is literally 5 seconds from now, and it just balloons.
Yeah, I agree. Because, you know, my suspicion about that was just like, if you look like the amount of sugar in these energy drinks,
mm-hmm.
have you seen Prime? I mean, one of these energy drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of sugar that is contained in them is actually a lot. So yeah. Sometimes I'm wondering, like, what is the combination, like, what is the correlation between, like, sugar and productivity, sugar, energy? Like, I get it, the sugar becomes energy, but...
Right. Well...
How does that help you productive?
There was an interesting thought that I heard on one of the podcasts, and I wish I could find it. It might have been, what is his name? Jimmy Fung? No, not Jimmy Fung. There was a fellow, he was a doctor, and he did one of the talks, either at the Ancestry Foundation talk, or maybe it was a Low Carb Down Under talk, or something like one of those conferences that are sort of in the space of keto, carnivore, diet, mm-hmm. and all of that. And he was saying that basically in your brain, there's one path for getting energy. And one of it is like heavily mediated, again, through insulin. So when you eat a lot of carb-heavy food, all of that stuff goes away and your brain doesn't have like half the doors open for energy inputs because the keys are all went to other place, to paraphrase it in a very primitive terms. And that's why, you know, you kind of like get zombified after you eat like a massive meal at lunch. Mm. I noticed that I did have that back in the day when I knew nothing about it. you know, we'd go for lunch and eat like a massive burrito with beef and rice. But that thing was like seriously like insanely huge. But it was like probably 70% of it was rice, right? So it was like a massive carb load. And then you go back to the office from lunch and you're just like completely dead.
Yeah, that's it. That's right.
But yeah, if I eat a nice massive steak, I don't have that effect. Like, it doesn't register. I remain productive. So it doesn't have nearly that effect. So I don't know. Maybe it's the carbs.
Yeah, but you know what? One time, I was having this conversation with my friend. And then I was telling her how I feel about carnivore and, like, all the good stuff. I was really evangelizing it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then she asked me, like, so you don't eat sugar? And then I was like, and then she made a statement. She said, like, are you happy? I'm like, what do you mean? Are you happy? Like, but what she was really trying to ask me is, like, you know, sugar makes people happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was thinking, like, in carnivore, what do you think is the direct replacement for this? Like, I get it, like, you know,
I think maybe I think that's a fallacy, because it's like saying coffee gives you energy.
You don't think so?
No, it's not that I don't think so. It's that if you never drank coffee before and you drink coffee, you will get a boost for sure. But if you drink coffee every day, that first hit of coffee doesn't give you any boost. It brings you basically to your natural baseline, right? So consuming it so much puts you in a pit, and you have to consume it to just kind of get out of that pit a little bit. And I think the same thing happens with sugar. Like, because, you know, again, the weird drug analogy, it's like, people who consume drugs, they need more and more eventually because they become habituated to it.
Yeah. Right?
And why should that be different for any other chemical? So if you consume a lot of it, you become habituated to it. And if you're in a state of withdrawal, you're going to be very unhappy because you're in a state of withdrawal. And then you have a little bit of sugar and hey, you're back to your baseline. You're feeling good. Maybe you're not feeling great like you did in the beginning, because again, now you're in the pit. And you're just reaching back to where you should be originally, right? Whereas before, you were at your baseline, you get a hit, you get like way up there, but eventually that thing like stops working, right? And then you tend to associate, oh, sugar makes me happy. But it's like, no, sugar just brings you to where you normally would have been if you weren't eating sugar all the time. So to me, I feel that that's a fallacy. And because on carnivore, where I don't eat sugar, I mean, I am more happy in a sense because I don't have mood swings. I'm very stable in my mood. Like, I don't have to experience the lows to then have some sugar to compensate for it, right? So, yeah.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, fair enough. I think that's true. But for me, I didn't know how to reply, so we just, like, laughed about it. But because I was thinking, like, is it true? Because if you look in like the standard meals, the regular meals, mm-hmm. put it that way, there's a lot of sugar in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look everything, literally, it has to be sweet.
Mm-hmm. But,
and then I started thinking, like, what's the reason for that?
Mm.
Is it to get us to eat more?
Yeah.
Or
partially to too? Well, I mean, grain-based foods are really cheap to produce, right? And so the profit margin on those must be pretty nice overall. I mean, okay, well, grocery business profit margins are probably one of the lowest across any industry. So, but in terms of volume, you know, if they can get you to eat more, the profit margin per item is not as high, but in volume, it may be not too bad. And I don't know. I don't want to go for any kind of weird conspiracy theories, but I think
let's do it.
The market follows supply and demand, mm-hmm. and maybe we didn't realize that the demand can be artificially increased by, at least at first, by doing all of the weird food engineering that they do. Like how many people do you think worked on a Twinkie to make the best-selling product ever? They probably had like a lot of like chemists and people who are doing the flavor and color and mouthfeel and like all of these different, there's like a whole department working on things like that to make it as appealing as possible, right?
Mm-hmm. I imagine.
But you know, if a humble cow had as much of a marketing department as a Twinkie, we'd all be carnivores, because it's just, you know, the level of engineering that goes into selling it to people is impressive, and people buy it, and it makes it easy, and you know, but ultimately, is it good for you? I don't know. I feel like not really, just judging on the transformation that I had personally twice now, because I went on it, I experienced all of the positive effects off of it, and then I kind of like fizzled out off of it. And then I deliberately went on it again, and I started experiencing the same effects again. So that's two personal anecdotes from one person. So that's not conclusive in a sense. But at the same time, there's a lot of people who confirm through what they say a lot of the things that I've experienced myself too.
Yeah, I think I can say like when we shared notes about it, I think we had the same note, because like, one of the very first thing for me was the sleep. I was able to get good sleep. Even if I sleep for just like a few hours, when I wake up, I don't feel like, oh, I shouldn't have slept. You know, because sometimes when you go to sleep and you wake up, you don't feel rested. You feel even more tired than before you went to sleep. Then you start asking yourself like, oh, you shouldn't have slept. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things, I no longer feel this way. Like, when I go to sleep now, I wake up, I'm good. Like, I'm really good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really good. But I wanted to ask you something. I think one of the things about, like, when you talk to people about carnivore, the first thing that comes to mind is like, oh, so you eat only meat. Only meat. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, like, I think there are, like, different recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I'm curious, like, what's
right.
just, like,
right.
What's your day like when you
I think there's degrees to it, and a big side of this community is comprised of people who have all sorts of very unfortunate chronic illnesses, and they usually tend to go more extreme compared to a regular person that doesn't really have anything. So if you have some crazy problem with inflammation or arthritis, maybe it would work best for you to just go beef only type deal, you know, and water. Maybe, but not everybody's ready for that extreme, right? And I think when I started originally, I went that route to just kind of get everything, as much of it as possible, out. To have like the most pronounced effect. But that one was also the hardest one. And at the start, I wasn't really that good at cooking most of the meals, because it was not like an everyday thing. And I went through these like iterations of trying out different things, abandoning some things, adding other things. It was a journey, essentially. But it doesn't have to be restricted to just meat in a sense. It is animal based, right? So it's animal product. So I eat meat, I eat eggs, I eat dairy. Some people say that dairy doesn't really work for them, but like, I drink milk, I eat sour cream, I eat cheeses. And yeah, mostly beef, some chicken, pork, very, very little. I try to minimize the processed stuff, and my breakfasts are very consistent and have been for a very long time. Like, even if I slip off full carnivore in the meantime, my breakfasts still remain pretty much carnivore. I eat eggs with a lot of ground beef, which actually, you know, people also say, oh, this diet is so expensive. because they imagine you'd like eat like a ribeye every night, which would be very nice. I wouldn't mind, but the prices of beef are pretty crazy right now, so you kind of have to improvise. But for instance, I went to a butcher and I picked up a whole bunch of ground beef, $5 a pound, Canadian, and I maybe for breakfast I eat like 3 eggs and a third pound of beef. So that's what, like less than $2 in beef and a couple of dollars in eggs. That's not that expensive. And butter. Yeah. Lots of butter. I render my own butter. I have a big jar of it. So I buy butter and I render it down because it gets rid of all of the what's the sugars that are in, like lactose and stuff like that.
What does that mean, though? Like, what does it mean to render butter?
Oh, it's if you ever tried like ghee or clarified butter, that's what it is. You effectively boil it until most of the stuff precipitates, and then you kind of get the top and you have it. So it's it changes the flavor profile, and it also tends to stay and keep quite well. Like, I literally don't even refrigerate. I just have it in a jar in my cupboard, and I use it every day. So if I get a particularly lean batch of ground beef, I just like put a couple of dollops of butter into my eggs. So, and I've been eating like that for a really, 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 really long time. I mean, I keep track of it. I try to sort of keep track of how well I'm sticking to the diet, and I'm looking at it right now. And for breakfasts, my adherence has been 84%. So 84% of the time I am having a carnivore breakfast throughout. I think that's probably like a yearly type deal.
That's good. That's good. That's really good.
For dinners, it's been much better. But ever since my girlfriend had birthday party and I had a bunch of stuff, it kind of plummeted from there.
You had so, a few sugar, just a few pieces.
Just a few pieces. Yeah, it tends to mess it up. So right now it's at 35%. But it in July, it was close to 75. So
that was good.
So I can't say that I'm 100%. I'd like to be. However, the social aspects are also there. My girlfriend does not follow the same way of eating. And, you know, to keep our domestic relationship going well, I can't just say no to everything she cooks. That would be a very, very bad move on my part.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not losing hope of getting her to our side one day. It'll make a lot of things much easier logistically and everything else.
Yeah. But, you know, when I started doing carnivore, and I realized that I got so much energy, you know, I was wondering what I would do with this energy, And then I started, like, just picking up different things. Then it hit me, you know. I wanted to ask you, do you see yourself as the kind of person who would want to have a company? Like, build a company.
Right. I think entrepreneurial skill set is very different from engineering skill set. And I think if you look at like engineering skill set and a managerial skill set, there's very little overlap. Entrepreneurial side has to cover both. And for me personally, like my management chops are not particularly great. This is something that I'm trying to work on right now at my company with the help of my manager. Like, she's trying to get me to a better level of that side of things. Because when it comes to engineering questions, like, I have no problem doing those. But when it comes to managerial things, it's not really, like, it's not my strength. So it makes things difficult for me. And entrepreneurial side, it's like that times 100 plus you're personally invested into everything you do. Like, if you work for a company, you're invested to some degree, but when you're working for your own company, you're invested into it like 100%. And any setbacks or any failures have immediate effect. So, you know, it's very high risk. And I'm mostly risk averse. or at least I have to have a good understanding of outcomes. But that also requires like some degree of strategic planning and foresight and a whole bunch of skills that I don't have. And I think it's fine. I think that if you're entrepreneurial, it's pretty much guaranteed that like your first 3 to 5 startups are going to fail, like pretty much 100%, they're going to fail. But if you are persistent and you're sticking with it, each failure gives you, it highlights the gaps in your skills and tells you what you need to know so that you don't fail next time. But next time you fail in a completely different areas. And as you start plugging those holes across your skill portfolio, eventually, if you haven't been completely demoralized by failure by then, you're going to have something successful.
Yeah.
But that's the thing too, is the mental resilience of not becoming demoralized. And you have to be willing to risk things. You have to be willing to risk your lifestyle. And so, you know, I mean, it's not unheard of, but, you know, starting a company when you're 40 and starting a company when you're 20 are different things in terms of everything that depends on you. And like, can you afford these types of risks? I mean, my parents immigrated to Canada when they were in their 40s. So that was a huge undertaking, like completely life-changing undertaking for them. So, you know, these things happen.
Yeah, but you see. So, okay. So this is the question. Yeah. I had this conversation with someone during the week. We talked about like different things that I was doing. And then the person asked me like, well, how do you feel about like having your own company, like your own tech company, or having a business where you don't have to hire anybody and it's just like, this is just you?
Mm-hmm.
And which one would you prefer?
Right. Well, I mean, I did a little bit of consulting back in the day where it's just essentially me coming in into other companies and solving technical problems for them, in a sense, you could describe it. So under, you know, technically correct is the best kind of correct. And like technically that was a, you know, solo entrepreneurial mm-hmm. type thing, but not, mm-hmm. not to the fullest extent. And I worked at startups and I've seen people starting their own companies and I know how much of an effort it is. And it's mm-hmm. like a 24/7 job. And if you want to succeed, you have to put a lot of effort into it all the time. And, you know, again, coming back to like, if you're that type A personality that, you know, wake up at 4:30 and get on a grind, mm-hmm. you are more likely to succeed in that. And myself, I don't know. I don't know if I would necessarily enjoy it, because in when I work on solving engineering and technical problems, you tend to become very focused on one particular area. But in entrepreneurship and running a company, you have to be focused on like 15 different things at a time. And I don't know if my brain is necessarily wired that way. So maybe I'm just hyping myself out of it, saying, oh yeah, that's just not how my brain is wired, I'm not going to be good at it. Or maybe I'm just not that good at it. And right now at this stage, if I were to try, the consequences of failure would outweigh the benefits. So like, I don't know if I'm ready to fail 5 times in a row at this point.
Yeah, you know, it's like learning how to ride a bike. I was, we're talking about this, over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, last week. And then we were talking about how it's not too late to learn how to ride a bike. Like you can be like, you know,
mm-hmm.
in your 30s and still be learning. And then I was saying like, there's an age where you get to, like if you fall at that point and you break a bone, it's difficult for that bone to heal, you know, like.
But if you're sticking to the carnivore lifestyle, your bone strength is going to be much better. So it's likely that even if you fall, you're not going to break your bone.
I think we have to mention that we're not doctors, but you know, You might want to believe that, but we're not doctors.
Yes.
Anyway, the reason why I mentioned this was just because, like, it was just how you said it, like, you know, yeah, then you might get to a certain stage of your life where you don't want to really take a lot of risk. But I'm curious, like, if you get to give advice, hypothetically, so let's say I come to you and I'm like, oh, Lee, I want to start a company, a tech company.
Mm-hmm.
What would be your first five advice?
First to five?
Yeah. First See. Five. Do you have up to five?
You got to be asking that type of question to somebody who actually done it and have succeeded. So I don't know if my advice is actually worth anything in this particular subject.
I mean, you must have seen things. You have been around. Yes. You've seen businesses succeed. You've seen the ones that didn't.
I'm starting to get flashbacks now. yeah, no, I mean, definitely, I did work at startups. We founded a startup with a couple of friends of ours, and you know, it failed for various reasons. A lot of them were personally my fault. So I think the advice would be, like, you have to take responsibility for everything. And this is the area where you have to be in a mindset of, okay, what am I not doing right? What am I not covering? Like, how is it my fault that things are not succeeding? Like, it's not one of the things that you can just blame on other people where things don't go your way. So you have to be prepared for failure and plan, have good long-term strategic planning, and maybe, I don't know when to cut your losses. Yeah, I don't know if I'm really positioned to give that type of advice, because my bias of person who's not very entrepreneurially suited will find 15 reasons why you shouldn't be starting a company. Whereas a person who wants to start a company probably needs the kind of motivation to be like, yeah, you know, go for it. It'll work out, obviously. Because you have to trip over all of those things yourself and understand where you're insufficient to, you know, build yourself up for that. And because I haven't gone through that process successfully, my advice is worth completely nil.
You know, I really appreciate your response, honestly, because that's like you've been completely honest. But you know, like in life, you can't just remain optimistic. Like, we need every part of it. We need being the people that see, like, oh, yes, it's going to work. And we need the people that think about why it's not going to work first. So, like, you need to find the balance between the two. So let's say I come to you, of course, the mindset of, you know, I'm really excited about my idea and it's going to work. I'm just curious about, like, where do you even start from, really?
I think that's a good question. You know, it's kind of funny. A bunch of years back, there was this conference, or I don't know, it was called Startup Weekend. Where it was not a conference, it was more like an event where, you know, people would buy tickets to the Startup Weekend thing, and then they all gather together for a couple of days and pitch ideas and find teammates and try to, like, build something and execute, like, deliver some sort of proposal by the end of it to, like, a panel of judges. And I went there, and when people were pitching their ideas, like, 98% of them were so bad. Like, so bad. It was like, oh, I want to build something that is... I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember specifically how they explained it. But what it boiled down to is, like, I want to build a LinkedIn, but for dentists. And it's like, yeah, it's called LinkedIn. Right? Or I want to build Facebook for accountants. It's like, yeah, it's called Facebook. So they had these ideas that they were, like, trying to, like, combine something with some niche. And it's like... there's no point. There's no point in trying to serve a tiny niche when there's already a competitor that does everything for everybody and you're going to be competing with them for a tiny niche. So a lot, like, there were maybe one or two kind of clever ideas that was like, oh, I don't know if it could work, but this is actually pretty interesting. Most of it was just banal and boring and already existing in a different way. So maybe the first thing is, how can I be sure that this is really necessary?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Like, is it solving a problem, really?
Mm-hmm. And is your solution, like, are you a solution in search of a problem, first of all? Like, is the problem real, or are you trying to make pretend that it is a problem and then offer a solution for it? Because I think a lot of startups these days are basically in that category.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. There was a time in my career as well where I was really like really into like startups.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we met in a startup. Was it a startup, right?
Yeah, it was a startup. I wasn't in the startup, but I was co-worker with the co-founder of the startup, so that's how we got connected.
Yeah, so like there was a time where like, and then I've seen some ideas and I was actually working on, interestingly, I would work on the idea. It's not like I wasn't completely sold. Like I know like what this idea is not really solving a problem, or the problem that it's solving has already been solved, and this is like another layer of solution.
Mm-hmm.
That is not really, anyway, point is like you're right, like you need to really figure out like the problem that you are trying to solve is an actual problem, and it's not like you are,
and it also could be your problem. It might not be like a problem at large.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So even if you did something that solves somebody's problem, and okay, maybe they either don't perceive it as their problem or they haven't been clued in to the benefits, because you could be legitimately building something that can give people benefits. They haven't been thinking about it from that angle. And once you kind of convey that, they might see it and be like, oh, actually that makes sense. You know, the second problem is getting them to part with their money for it. That part is hard. Like you think finding something that people actually need solved is hard? Figuring out a way to get them to pay you for it is like 10 times, 100 times as hard. And then the third part is, how scalable is it? You know, we went to these courses, again, in another startup, we went to these courses and they were like throwing out the fancy terms of like total addressable market. How big is your total addressable market? How many customers are there on planet Earth that could potentially buy your product? Because if it's 5 and you spend 2 years building it, now you have to sell it a couple of $1 million per copy each, right? So, you know, it has to solve somebody's problem. They have to be willing to part with their money for it. And there has to be a lot of people around to make it all worthwhile. So even though I haven't been necessarily successful in all of these, I think if you can answer all those three questions, I have to think of two more now. That's already being in a good position, you know.
You see, you're ready. Maybe you just don't believe that much in like how much you can do, you know. Maybe you really can do it.
I don't know if I can do it myself. I can hype other people up or tell them that they can't do it for reasons, of course. So you know, that's why consulting exists. You go and tell other people what they want to hear, and then they pay you lots of money for it.
That's a skill, you know.
Yeah, it is. You have to believe in it too. So
they think you would. Do you consider these things as like a retirement plan, like becoming a consultant, or like even before retirement?
Oh man, I don't know. I mean, I was saying how my mood is very even on carnivore, but when I start thinking about retirement, it just sort of tanks.
Yeah, carnivore doesn't help you that much.
Yeah, listen, especially with the prices of beef going up as they are, it's like my runway is shrinking every day, you know. I mean, if you have a skill, it's great. If you have skills in an intersection of two different areas that complement each other, that's even better. And if you have a third area that, like, the more disparate areas that you can kind of aggregate under the same umbrella and have skills in that, you'll be able to sell yourself, I believe.
Yeah.
You have to actually know how to do something.
Yeah. You know, like, just a last point. I remember, like, I was having a conversation with Elliot today, and we were talking about being entrepreneurial, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then in the conversation, the person said, like, oh, you know, me, I'm not entrepreneurial. Just like you mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't think you are. But, you know, like, I think everything is a business. Like, if you work 9 to 5 and, or if you have a real estate or whatever you do, everything is a business. It depends on what you are selling.
Yeah.
For us, if you work, like, you sell your time.
Yeah.
Your time is what you sell. So, like, you have to, the way to scale this business is to make your time more valuable.
Right.
And I think that's the way I see everything, really. Like, it's a product.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if it's worth saying, like, oh, you're not entrepreneurial, but you do all of this. For example, if you want to become a consultant, it's not like you just wake up tomorrow morning and be like, yeah, voila, I'm a consultant now. You must have invested a lot of time making yourself
valuable. Consulting is you have to be able to make people understand where your value comes from, and you also have to have connections. Because it's one of those areas where you're not just going to walk through the door and be like, hey, hire me. Maybe. I don't know. But probably, like, you have to have a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And reputation takes a long time to build. And I think now, in the era of remote, building a reputation has become different. Now, we were talking about creating content, right? Because if you can't, people are less inclined to meet face-to-face, I noticed. And talking to my friends, it's like, I hear this a lot where, you know, oh, can we just do a Zoom instead type deal? I don't know if it's ubiquitous, but there's definitely a big chunk of that. And so, whereas before you go to a conference and meet a lot of people, or, you know, there's all these social aspects, now they're less likely, less pronounced. Like, last time I went to Polyglot Conference in Vancouver, it shrunk down in terms of its attendance quite considerably. Like, I was surprised of how quaint and cozy it gotten again, like it was the first year or something, because it used to be pretty big, but then COVID hit and it disappeared. And maybe it'll rise again. But yeah, now you have to be noticed through other means. So you said you started writing your blog, you're getting some degree of traction with it. I started, I mentioned last time that, like, oh, I haven't had time to go write in my blog, but then recently I wrote a bunch of stuff in my blog. And, you know, I posted a link to it to one of the comments on Hacker News, and a couple of hundred people came in and, like, at least looked at it. So, you know, it's possible that you can grow your brand effectively. And, you know, doing YouTube is growing your brand. And if you want to be a consultant and sell yourself, you need to build the brand. And then you have no trouble selling it. So maybe, I mean, yeah, maybe there is a mercantile interest that I have not admitted to myself. It's like, oh, yeah, I just want to share the knowledge. But maybe it is just part of, you know, building a brand that I can sell later on. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I think what we do here is valuable.
Yeah. But do you see now? Do you get my point? Like, at the end of the day, we are all doing business in a way.
Yes.
At the end of the day.
I mean, you have to. And I think the worse economic conditions outside of you become, the more entrepreneurial everybody suddenly gets. Because, hey, you know, if you want to live well, you got to hustle.
You have to make the coins.
Yes.
The papers.
The schmeckles.
That's about it, Vasily. That's all I planned for us today. And I really thank you for your wise words and your time.
Well,
it's really good.
Yeah.
Good to talk to you.
It was a good conversation. I was having fun. Hopefully, you know, we haven't put off too many people by our carnivorous ways. Out of because you know, at this time the channel has grown to 27 subscribers since the 24 last time, so a loss of even one would be pretty significant percentage drop. So we have to be more conscious of that.
No, I think it's a good testimony from us, like, you know, like,
yeah people ultimately
want
it
to
is.
Do it. Mm-hmm. People want, I think, when you look. So for me, I read a bunch of articles about carnivore,
mm-hmm.
and what I noticed is that, you know what? I have more questions about carnivore. So at what point did it become a general thing for everybody to think vegetables are good for you? Mm. I think it was more commercial than actually, but maybe we'll get into it next week.
Yeah, maybe we'll get to it next week. as a teaser. I think we kind of had to when all of the megafauna went extinct. I don't know if because we ate it all or something else happened, but suddenly there weren't enough mountains of meat roaming around, so we had to get creative. We had to get entrepreneurial and figure out farming, because what else are you going to do?
I guess, yeah. But anyway, we'll get into it next week and we'll discuss more about it.
All right. It was a pleasure having a chat with you, Mo, as always. And for everybody's watching, thank you for being with us and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.